We are very pleased to have a graduate student, Adam Michaud, here today to discuss the works of Ray Bradbury. I'd like to invite Tracy Doherty, author and distinguished professor in the English department at OSU, to introduce Adam today.
Thank you, Deborah. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Adam to you. Adam comes to us by way of New Hampshire, where he earned an MA in literature at the University of New Hampshire, and where he taught in an alternative high school for the arts. Currently, Adam is a second-year student in the Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing at Oregon State University, where he also teaches writing. While he's been in Corvallis, Adam has been working on a delightful coming-of-age novel, which nicely shows the mystery and the quirkiness of being young. And so I trust that Adam will soon finish this novel and that someday it will be available for you all to read, and that when you do read it, you'll see traces of yourself in it, because Adam is a wonderful observer of human nature. When Deborah first mentioned today's topic to me, I thought immediately of Adam because we had had a conversation not long ago about Ray Bradbury, and I know how important Bradbury is to Adam. In fact, he has a marvelous tattoo related to Bradbury. I don't know if you can persuade him to show it to you, but maybe you can at least ask him about it. In any case, I'm delighted that he has agreed to talk to us today about the master. When a student as talented and passionate as Adam comes along, it makes the teacher's task easy. I know that my job is basically to stay out of his way and to let him do what he does best, and to try not to mess him up too much. So it's with great pride that I give you Adam Michaud.
Gather up some of my materials here. Just so you know, you'll be hearing a timer go off. I need to live by this when I do these longer things. Otherwise, I just ramble on forever. So that'll beep at 10 minutes to warn me that I'm getting too close. I want to thank you all for coming. I'm really pleased to see how many of you come out to hear me talk about Bradbury. And I want to thank Tracy, of course, for that amazing introduction. I'm in his class tomorrow, so let's hope that I can live up to what he's just said. But I was really excited when I was asked to do this review because, as Tracy said, Bradbury is a very important author to me. He is probably one of my favorite authors of all time. He's also the author that I sort of blame, I guess, for wanting to become a writer myself. Sort of came to him in high school and sort of saw writing in a different way when I first read some of his work. But there's also this sort of a challenge in my job today, because I have to sort of cover the works of Ray Bradbury in about 45 minutes. Well, Bradbury has been writing for 70 years. His first story was published in 1938, and he wrote right up until his death in 2012. During that time, he wrote what most people consider to be 11 novels. And I say most people consider them to be 11 novels because he had this sort of one peculiar habit of doing what they called fix-up novels. And is anybody familiar with what the fix-up is? Anybody even heard this term before? So what would happen is he would write a bunch of short stories, and they would have a similar geography, or they would fit on a similar sort of chronology. And they would take all these stories together and put them together into a book, make some little connections, and call it a novel. The Martian Chronicles, for one, is probably his most famous fix-up novel. Those actually started as a bunch of short stories. Dandelion Wine is another book that fits into this category, that really those are short stories. So some people talk about those as collections. Some people talk about them as novels. In addition to these 11 novels, he also has over 40 collections of short work. And within these 40 collections, there's about 400 to 600 short stories, depending, again, on who you talk to. Incredibly prolific, right? One of the things that makes it hard to say how many he has is because of this sort of habit of doing fix-ups. Do you count the short story as short story that becomes the chapter in the novel? Right. So that's sort of one of the challenges of talking about Bradbury's sort of volume. But beyond this, he's also a writer for stage. He was active in the LA theater community his entire life. He's written for film. In fact, one of his first commercially sort of paying jobs was actually to write the screenplay for Moby Dick. And he's also written tons of television. He actually had his own show. I don't know if you know this, but there was Ray Bradbury's Theater, which was sort of a Twilight Zone-style show in the 70s and 80s. So he's sort of all over the place. He's also got 12 collections of essays, right? And he writes on everything from writing to culture to film to his own experiences. guy's kind of all over the place. And if you're so inclined, he's even got two collections of poetry. Right? And on top of this, he's won countless awards. So how do you sort of sum all this up, right? He's won the O'Henry Award twice. He's got the National Medal of for the Arts. He's won the National Book Association Award. He's got an Emmy for his television work. He's even got a Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame, right? And then if that doesn't impress you, he's got a crater and an asteroid named in his honor. So how do you sort of talk about this guy in 45 minutes? How do you sum this all up in a way that sort of can talk about his whole body of work? And when you look at sort of the way that most people talk about him and think of him, is he's a science fiction writer. You look at the poster, and the three covers that are on the poster all say that he's our greatest living, at the time, science fiction author. So he gets this sort of label. And that's always been sort of a weird, sort of problematic label for me, considering there's really only three of his books would be really categorized as science fiction if you're taking that definition sort of liberally. In fact, in the 80s, he wrote mostly detective fiction. For those of you that have read Dandelion Wine or Something Wicked This Way Comes, those are both sort of coming-of-age stories that have sort of horror components, but very little science fiction. So how can we talk about an author that's written upwards of 60 books in terms of science fiction? That seems like a sort of a misnomer to me. And I'm not the only one that feels this way. In fact, within the critical community and sort of among critics, there's a lot of debate about, do we call him a science fiction writer? In fact, some of the most critical people of his work are actually the people within the science fiction community. And they have two problems with Bradbury. One, he doesn't play by the rules of physics. So some of the science fiction people actually refer to him as the anti-science fiction writer. And so they sort of make fun of him in some ways. Or they call him, what was the phrase that they used? Oh, a Midwestern surrealist was one of the terms that somebody came up with, which I don't really know what that means. But and I kind of agree with this, because when I teach these stories, to teach Bradbury's stories to my students, I talk about him, I sort of pitch him as, you know, if you don't like science fiction, okay, because the science fiction really isn't the important part. And I sort of set it up almost like a joke, waiting for a punchline, right? That Bradbury's stories are about two guys, they get on a rocket ship, they go to Mars, they're alone, and the first guy says, and then the story starts. So the rocket ship really isn't the important part. So the question then is, you know, what do we do with Bradbury then if we can't talk about him as a science fiction author? One other thing that I forgot to mention. One of the criticisms of Bradbury is that he was a Luddite, or a Luddite for most of his life, right? He never learned to drive, hated cell phones, dismissed all of sort of modern technology as too much of those internets. I love that, the internets, right? And until basically the very end of his life, he refused to allow his books to be published as a digital e-reader. And that was basically at the very end of his life, he made an agreement with his publishers to finally do that, but only if the books were made available to the libraries for with sort of special privileges, if you will. I lost my place here. The fans of science fiction also refer to him as non-factual. That's the other sort of problem they have with him. So what I wanted to figure out when I was thinking about this, and I was coming across all these people that were criticizing Bradbury's science fiction, they weren't matching up with why I didn't feel like he was science fiction. So I wanted to look at why my sort of experience was so different from everybody else's. So what you have to do, you have to imagine me at 14. This is when I read Bradbury. So I'm in a new town, right? I have a new stepfather. I'm in a new school, just starting high school, just coming out of puberty. Probably a little bit angry, probably a little bit sort of confused, right? And up to this point, I'd read a couple of his short stories, All Summer and a Day, The Veldt. These are stories that are collected for junior high readers. But when I get into high school, I'm suddenly required to read a book. So I pick up this one. It's Fahrenheit 451. And I picked this book mostly because there's a cool dude on the cover on fire. And also because it's a relatively thin book, right? These are the important things to you when you're a 14-year-old boy, right? So I pick this book up and I start reading it. And this is what I read. And I want to read you just the opening sort of section of Fahrenheit. It was a pleasure to burn. It was a special pleasure to see things eaten, to see things blackened and changed,
With the brass nozzle in his fists, and with this great python spitting its venomous kerosene upon the world, the blood pounded in his head, and his hands were the hands of some amazing conductor, playing all the symphonies of blazing and burning to bring down the tatters and charcoal ruins of history. With a symbolic helmet numbered 451 and on his stolid head, and his eyes all orange flame with the thought of what came next, he flicked the igniter, and the house jumped up in a gorging fire that burned the evening sky red and yellow and black. He strode in a swarm of fireflies. He wanted, above all, like the old joke, to shove a marshmallow on a stick into the furnace, while the flapping pigeon-winged books died on the porch and the lawn of the house, while the books went up in sparkling whirls and blew away and the wind turned black and burning. Montag grinned the fierce grin of all men singed and driven back by flame. He knew that when he returned to the firehouse, he might wink at himself, a minstrel man burned cork in the mirror. Later, going to sleep, he would feel the fiery smile still gripped by his face muscles in the dark. It never went away, that smile. It never went away as long as he remembered, right? So this is the opening to this book, and there's nothing science fiction in that to me. But it still blew me away. That there was something dangerous in that opening. For a 14-year-old boy to be told that there was pleasure in burning, and especially burning books, right? That's heresy. And I do consider it heresy now. So I kept reading. And I get to the end of this book, and how many of you have read this particular book? I'm curious. All right, good. So this particular book, of course, is one of his most famous. And for those of you that don't know, the premise of this book is that it's a futuristic society. You have these firemen whose job it is to burn books that have been banned by the government, right? And this particular guy is in love with his job until one day he opens up a ceiling panel in a house he's supposed to burn, and a book falls out, and it falls open. And he reads one line, and that changes everything. And without even thinking about it, he closes the book and tucks it under his arm, under his coat, and he takes it home. And now Guy Montag, the main character, is suddenly the very thing that he's supposed to destroy. He's a keeper of contraband, right? And so, of course, his life unravels, and he ends up in this sort of secret society that is basically charged themselves with maintaining books. And they do this not by protecting them from the firemen, by hiding them, but by memorizing them, right? So we get that mirror of what he remembers about the fire is also ultimately what keeps him sort of in love with books, is he has to memorize these books. So for me, what was amazing about this wasn't the science fiction. It was the fact that Bradbury was writing about a guy that could literally be changed by a single sentence, right? He could be changed by a single book. And that suddenly opened books up in this new way for me, that this was a powerful thing. So it wasn't the science fiction in this book that caught me. And there's plenty of it in here. There's this demonic hound, this mechanical robot that can chase people down, right, and find them based on just the smell of their DNA, and it won't give up until they're dead. Like, that's sort of one of the premises of the book. And of course, Montag has to run from this beast. And then in addition to that, there's these gigantic television rooms where each wall is a whole TV screen, right, and people sit in the middle of it, and they sort of become part of the show. And if you're rich enough in this world, you can have a fourth wall and be completely immersed. And this might be actually one of the most prophetic moments of Bradbury, because I think we're getting pretty close to that now with the 72-inch screen TVs, right? So this is that moment where he was that forward-thinking scientist. He doesn't usually do that, but he definitely got that one right. So for me, it was the fact that this is really a story that does something different. And it's this sort of fast and loose way that Bradbury uses science fiction, with the exception of the TV room. His science isn't really science. I mean, what makes the hellhound so dangerous is the fact that it is this sort of supernatural entity, even though it's made from science, right? It's the supernatural component of that makes that stick with us. So, and it's sort of this sort of loose playing with the science that makes science fiction critics sort of get latherous about him. They're like, they get all frothy and sort of angry about Bradbury being called science fiction. So what ends up happening is critics actually start apologizing for the science fiction in Bradbury. They start coming up with these elaborate excuses for how he uses science fiction, trying to justify that. In the preface to Martian Chronicles,
There is a critic by the name of Kim Robinson who tries to apologize for the mistakes that he made with science by arguing that he based his reality of the novel on cultural perceptions of what Mars was like at the time. So we can't fault Bradbury. He got it right because he was just doing what everybody else is doing, right? And she goes as far as to say that we can actually call Bradbury hard science fiction because he was right for the time. And I think that's an awful lot of sort of logical twisting and turning to make this guy fit into these sort of narrower definitions of what science fiction is. So if we're not going to call him sci-fi, how do we justify his timelessness, right? Do we call him horror? Do we call him fantasy? Bradbury himself refers to his own work as weird tales, which I think is fun. I always sort of prefer when I talk about it with my students, I refer to it as fantastic tales, borrowing from those sort of old pulp magazines that he got his start in. But ultimately, I think Bradbury is the person to go to if we really want to understand how to read all of his work, not just the three science fiction books. If we want to really understand how to read all of his work, we can go to him. And in the beginning of Martian Chronicles, again, in his own preface, he says this. he asks, how come Martian Chronicles is often described as science fiction? It misfits that description. There is only one story in the entire book that obeys the laws of technical physics. So Bradbury's even questioning, he's even challenging this sort of description. And of course, that sort of negation comes just three pages after Kim Robinson has spent all this time sort of defending him as a science fiction writer, right? But then further on into this, we get a sort of a better sense of why Bradbury feels this way. And he tells a story of working in L.A. and working in basically theater in L.A. And at the time, he was actually doing a stage adaptation of some of the Martian Chronicles work, okay? So he's in L.A., and at the same time, this is when the Tutankhamun exhibit was traveling around. And Bradbury is a lifelong fan of Egyptology. It's one of the things that he sort of cut his teeth on when he was very young. It was the first thing that caught his imagination. So he spends his days going to the museum and looking at this exhibit. And then he spends his nights at the theater watching his performers, watching his actors mount this new production. And this is what he says about the experience. Moving back and forth from Tut to theater, theater to Tut, my jaw dropped. My God, I said, gazing at Tutankhamun's golden mask, that's Mars. My God, I said, watching my Martians on stage, that's Egypt with Tutankhamun's ghosts. So what starts to happen in Bradbury's own sort of recognition of his work is that he actually starts to see that maybe he's not writing about the future, right? Which is one of the goals of science fiction, is to write about potential futures. He's actually writing about the past. He's retelling these stories, and he's taking them, he's transporting them to different geographies, but he's really retelling our own myths, right? And if you don't believe me, he goes on further, and this is what he actually says about the Martian Chronicles. He finally gives us a definitive answer of how to read the Martian Chronicles. He says, all right then, what is Chronicles? It is King Tut out of the tomb when I was 3. It is Norse Eddas when I was 6. It is Roman and Greek gods that romanced me when I was 10. It is pure myth, right? And suddenly that opens up. When I found that opened up, and it made so much more sense to me that the work of Bradbury sort of all fits into this one sort of simple category. He's writing modern myth, right? And some of it's science fiction, some of it's detective fiction, some of it's horror. And it sort of opened my eyes to how we can sort of go about this. And we have to think about myth in this sense in sort of the broadest possible way, of course. And I think of it sort of in the way that we think of all oral tradition, right? That all of our folk tales, all of our legends, all of our sort of modern urban myths, even those stories about the escaped convict that's scratching the door, right? All those stories are part of this same mythology that Bradbury is drawing from. And to that, then, we can also add all the classic stories that we all know, right? The Grimm's fairy tales. Shakespeare. I mean, how many of you wouldn't be able to give me a fairly decent narrative plot summary of Romeo and Juliet, right? So there's a play that has left the page and become part of this collective mythology of what it is to be alive today. And just because it's not 2,000 years old doesn't make it any less mythological, if you will, right? So if we want to see this in his work, we don't have to look very far. And we can see how he's using not only the myths of the past, but also sort of this this modern retelling, if you will, of or this modern mythologizing of our world in the very first section of Martian Chronicles. So in this, we see a Martian house homemaker, right? Just a woman. She's dusting her house with magic Martian dust that collects dust, and she can throw the whole thing out, sort of like a Swiffer of the Martian age. So she eats a Martian apple that just happens to grow out of the walls of her house. So we're already getting these, and it's a golden apple, of course, right? So we're already getting these hints of the myths that we already know. Golden apples, they show up. That's like one of those sort of tropes that shows up everywhere in mythology, right? And then we meet Mr. K, her husband, and he's sort of this quintessential sort of absentee husband, doesn't really pay enough attention to her. And again, we're seeing sort of the American myth of domestic life, right? That there's this sort of domestic tranquility that we're all supposed to buy into. And here's an example of it just transported to Mars. Then overlaying on this, we get Mr. K's actual sort of day-to-day routine. And it says, afternoons when the fossil sea was warm and motionless and the wine tree stood stiff in the yard and the little distant Martian bone town was all enclosed and no one drifted out of their doors, you could see Mr. K himself in his room reading from a metal book with raised hieroglyphs, which he brushed his hand as one might play a harp. And again, we get that already. We have that image of Egypt, right? Hieroglyphs. And then the book says, then from the book, that as his fingers stroked, a voice sang. Suddenly, it's a magical book, right? It's singing to him. It's telling him a story, and it's in a soft, ancient voice, which told tales of when the sea was red as red steam on the shore, and ancient men carried clouds of metal insects and electric spiders into battle, right? So here's a guy in sort of the modern myth of domestic life reading about the myths of his own culture. So we get this sort of mythology upon mythology. In the very first section, I'm cheating a little bit. There's a paragraph and a half before that that's just about rocket ships. but it's not even a chapter. It's like a prologue, so I'm sure. Don't tell anyone. But then the story goes on from there, right? And we start to see other things, that these are the everyman, or the every Martian, if you will. Mr. and Mrs. K were not old. They were the fair brownish skin of the true Martian, with yellow coin eyes and soft musical voices, right? They become these sort of stand-ins for all of Martian kind, in the same way that, you know, the Wicked Witch or the little rose-cheeked child stands in for everyone in our own mythology, in our own folktales, right? And then the story goes on from there, that it's not just in the language, it's not just in these descriptions that he's doing this. He actually starts to do it. Sorry, I'm losing my books here. And he actually starts to do it with the actual plot points of the story. So this particular story, the beginning of the story goes on, and it becomes just a story of jealousy. What happens is the wife, who's bored, of course, takes a nap, and she has a prophetic dream of the coming of the first Earthman. And she sees him come down in a silver ship from the heavens, and he lands, and he's tall, and he has dark hair and blue eyes. And she wakes up, she tells her husband, and immediately he's suspicious, right? And then, of course, she has the dream again, because, you know, you have to repeat these things if you're telling a myth, right? So suddenly, she has this dream again, and now the husband is sure she's going to stray. So he starts coming up with these elaborate excuses to keep her at home. You know, oh, the doctor's coming to visit. Oh, my mother's coming to visit. You can't leave. You have to be here while I'm at work. So he sort of traps her in this house. She becomes the quintessential trapped princess, right? And then suddenly, he goes out. It's a little bit of a weird leap, but he goes out with his gun. And it just so happens that that's the day that the first Earthman actually lands. Of course, the housewife is at home, stuck there. She hears the gun go off, and the dream is gone, right? So the first Earthman on Mars is shot by the first jealous husband of Mars, right? And it's not the oldest story ever told, but jealousy is probably one of the most often told stories in our culture, for sure, and throughout history. I mean, how many of Zeus's wives were turned into cows or stone or puddles of mud? Or, you know, we see this over and over again. So Bradbury's playing with those very same ideas. But of course, you know, the story doesn't end there. That's just the first chapter. What we have instead is a story of sort of human triumph in this situation. So they come again, and they're sort of pushed away again. Then they come again, and then the third time they're arrested for and committed to a Martian insane asylum because they think they're Earthlings, right? They're delusional Martians is what they are, right? So it takes one, two, three attempts by the Earthlings to to take over Mars, to conquer Mars. And again, we have that repetition, that sort of classic mythology, that classic fairy tale structure of threes, right? You have three little pigs, three Billy Goats Gruff, three visits from Rumpelstiltskin, three witches, three fates, three attempts by Apollo to stop the sacking of Troy, right? We see this over and over again. That's one of those tropes, again, of mythology, that repetition. But ultimately, they do succeed, right? And it becomes a story of human colonization of Mars. And what happens once they succeed is it changes. The story sort of shifts from these sort of classical representations, and the story starts to become more of a modern mythologization, if you will, of sort of our experience. And I just want to read you sort of that shift in here and see if you can hear the same sort of rhythms of myth telling and sort of magic, I guess, in the way this works, and the everyman and timelessness of this. This is a little bit of a hard section to read because there's only one period, so let me get a drink here. Actually, there might be three periods or something, but... The men of Earth came to Mars. They came because they were afraid or unafraid, because they were happy or unhappy, because they felt like pilgrims and did not feel like pilgrims. There was a reason for each man. They were leaving bad wives, bad jobs, bad towns. They were coming to find something or leave something or get something or to dig something up or bury something or leave something alone. They were coming from small dreams or coming with small dreams or large dreams or none at all. But a government finger pointed to a four-color poster in many towns and said, "There's work for you in the sky. See Mars." Again, that poster is sort of that's part of our own American mythology, right? The Uncle Sam posters, the propaganda posters of the Great Wars, right? That's part of this cultural sort of way that we think about our whole existence. And the men shuffled forward, only a few at first, a double score. Most men felt the great illness in them before the rocket even fired into space. And it was a disease called the loneliness. It's capital L, loneliness, right? Sort of like the capital T, truth. Because when you saw your hometown dwindle to the size of your fist, and then the lemon size, and then pin size, and vanish in the fire wake, and you'd felt you'd never been born, and there was no town, and you were nowhere with space all around and nothing familiar, only other strange men, and then the state of Illinois and Iowa and Missouri and Montana vanished into a cloud of seas. And doubly, when the United States shrank to the misted island and the entire planet Earth became a muddy baseball tossed away, then you were alone, wandering in the meadows of space, on your way to a place you couldn't imagine. It was not unusual that first men were so few, but the number grew steadily in proportion to the census of the Earthmen already on Mars. There was comfort in numbers, but the first lonely ones, capital L, had to stand alone, right? So, again, we have this everyman sort of image, and again, we have this repetition, and it doesn't matter what town, it doesn't matter what nationality, it doesn't matter the motives. What's important is that they went on this journey. So it becomes this sort of timeless, everyman's story very quickly. And then, of course, from there he moves on, and the stories themselves of how they actually colonize Mars are going to sound pretty familiar. There's one Terra Firma character in the story. Terra Firmas are basically people that go to other planets and try to create an atmosphere by changing the geology and the landscape so that humans can live there. So one of the ways that they do this is a guy goes around and he plants trees. Anybody want to guess what kind of tree he plants? Apples, right? So we get this Johnny Appleseed character that's helping to turn Mars into Earth, right? And he travels around. And then there's other things that are really super specific that still somehow managed to remain universal. There's a character that opens a hot dog stand, pretty darn specific, but he opens it up at a crossroads on the frontier, right? And he just has to sit there. And the whole story is about how he just has to sit and wait. That they will come, right? It's a story we've heard before. I mean, this stand could substitute in for anybody on the frontier in our own history again, right? It could be the dry goods shop owner waiting for the gold rush to start. It could be the city transplant in the small town trying to restart a less stressful life by buying out the local coffee shop. Today, it could be the computer programmer, the website builder, sitting in his dorm room just waiting for people to click on his website, right? This is a story. This is that entrepreneurial spirit of the United States and pretty much the modern world. This is Mark Zuckerberg, right? Mark Zuckerberg went to Mars and had a pension for sausage, right? And then what happens then, too, is now once we get critical mass there, now we have to really change this place. So there's a whole section in the book on how the mountains need to be renamed and the valleys and the rivers need to be renamed. And so these new histories, these new stories are written over these places that already have histories and stories, right? So it becomes story upon story. And that's pretty much how myth and oral tradition works. We take the same stuff and we retell it, we pass it down, we change it based on the time period that we're in, and we update those stories. If you look at modern urban myths today, most of them have roots
in like the 1800s. Some of them go back as far as the Dark Ages. It's pretty amazing if you can trace those sorts of things. But timelessness, of course, isn't the only thing that makes for good myth and good fables. There has to be a certain quality of the fantastic. And Bradbury, of course, has that in spades. You know, in the Martian Chronicles, of course, there is literally we have the wife's prophetic dreams, right? That's a fantastic component. The very landscape of Mars is sort of fantastic. There's canals. There are these sort of strange cityscapes that we encounter. But there's also these sort of ghosts of those places that are left, as well as literal ghosts. There are ghost ships, desert sailing ships that float across the deserts of Mars even after the Martians are all dead. Their ships are still there. And then there's actual ghosts that speak through telepathy to the new colonists and try to change what they're doing, right? And we see this really a lot in his short fiction as well. It's really easy to see sort of the supernatural pieces there. His first commercially successful short story is Homecoming. Anybody familiar with Homecoming? It was sort of a miraculous story in a lot of ways. First of all, he submitted to Mademoiselle. Bradbury submitted to Mademoiselle. Okay, we'll buy that. But then it ends up in the slush pile, and to add to the miracle, it's in the slush pile, and it gets pulled from the slush pile by a young junior editor at Mademoiselle, Truman Capote. So Truman Capote reads Bradbury. I mean, that's an afternoon. I would have loved to have seen the after party for Capote where he's talking about that story, right? And then he publishes it. It gets into Mademoiselle, and it goes on to win Bradbury's first O. Henry Prize. So this story, Homecoming, just to make it even stranger, is about the family reunion of a family of vampires, werewolves, witches, and ghouls. So this is Truman Capote's choice for Mademoiselle. But what it is, what's the interesting thing about this story is that it's not about the monsters. What it's actually about is the youngest son. The youngest son is the outcast in the family. He's the weird one because he's human, right? He was born normal. And so the story becomes not a story of monsters, not a story of vampires drinking blood. It becomes a story of a little boy trying to find his place in his family. So Bradbury has taken that classic story of the sort of the monster outsider, you know, the Frankenstein story, and inverted it. And now the monster is the little kid. But his family is a good family, and they want to accept him, and they try to encourage him. And at the end of the story, it's not satisfying. He never really finds his place. The reunion's over, and he feels just as lost as always. He can never be quite as good as the other monsters in his family, right? He can't drink the blood. He can't telepathically transport his body to another place. He can't possess other people, right? He can't do any of these things. So he's sort of left in this sense. So ultimately, this is a story about all families. And it's that, again, that universality. And that's what good myth is supposed to do. One of his longer works, which I think captures this idea the best, for me, is Something Wicked This Way Comes. How many of you have read Something Wicked This Way Comes? It's one of his top four novels. We got a hand up high at the back. Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and it's probably one of the ones that I came to later in my sort of reading of Bradbury, and I was really excited when I found it because it has a lot of really poetic language in it as well. And as I said, Bradbury was a poet. But for those of you that don't know this, and most of you don't, this has nothing to do with science fiction. I don't think there's a single science fiction component in here. You might make an argument there's some lightning rods. That's kind of science-y. But for the most part, it's what is often given the equally limiting label of horror. And it's not really that either. So we can start to see how these sort of genre titles can't quite capture what Bradbury is doing. What the story is about is essentially a story of good and evil. It's a coming-of-age story. Two little boys living in Illinois. It's in the set in the same town as Dandelion Wine. This is basically the fall after the summer in Dandelion Wine. And it's the story of Will and Jim, who are at the point in their life where they have to basically choose the path that they're going to follow. Are they going to be good or are they going to be bad? Are they going to follow the path of light or the path of dark? And in this story, the good and the bad is represented by Will's father, who's an older gentleman. He's in his 50s. His son is only 10. So at the time in the 50s, that was sort of unusual. And then sort of the evil is represented by, of course, Mr. Dark. who owns a carnival, and he's young and charismatic, and he comes to town on this magic train, basically, bearing this carnival. I wanted to read to you sort of how this train is introduced. You can see how the myth is playing out in a slightly different way in a piece that isn't dealing with sort of the science fiction stuff. So this is a little bit of a long passage, but what has happened is the train has come in the middle of the night, and Jim and Will have snuck out of their houses, run down to the field by the train tracks, and they're hiding in the bushes watching this train unload. And at first, there's no noise. It's almost like the train is abandoned. So they're sort of surprised by this. And they're laying there, and they're waiting for something to happen, right? And this is what they see. It's as if exhaling itself straight down from the sky, a vast moss-green balloon touched at the moon. It hovered 200 yards above and away, quietly riding the wind. There's a basket under the balloon. Someone's in it. But then a tall man stepped down from the train caboose platform like a captain, assaying the tidal waters of this inland sea. All dark suit, shadow-faced, he waded into the center of the meadow, his shirt as black as the gloved hands he now stretched to the sky. He gestured once, and the train came to life. At first, a head lifted in one window, then an arm, then another head like a puppet in a marionette theater. Suddenly, two men in black were carrying a dark tent pole out across the hissing grass. It was the silence that made Will pull back. And we see the boy who's going to choose light is already sort of responding to this. Even as Jim leaned forward, eyes moon bright. The carnival should be all growls, roars like Thunderland stacked, bundled, rolled, and crashed. Giant explosions of lion dust, men ablaze with working anger, pop bottles jangling, horse buckles shivering, engines and elephants in full stampede through rains of sweat while zebras neighed and trembled like cage trapped in cage. But this was like the old movies, the silent theater haunted with black and white ghosts. Silvery mouths opened to let the moonlight smoke out, gestures made in silence so hushed you could hear the wind fuzz the hair on your cheek. More shadows rustled from the train, passing the animal cages, where darkness prowled with unlit eyes, and the calliope stood mute, save for the faintest idiot tune that the breeze piped wandering up the flues. The ringmaster stood in the middle of the land, the balloon, like a vast, moldy green cheese, stood fixed in the skies. Then the darkness came. The last thing Will saw was the balloon swooping down in clouds, as clouds cover the moon. Right? So in this passage, one, we already have sort of the expectation of what a carnival train is supposed to be like. We have Will's perspective that all these things are supposed to be happening. It's supposed to be loud. There's my 10-minute warning. And it's supposed to sort of be this cacophonous thing, right? And it's not. So we have this sort of expectation, this sort of myth of what a boy thinks, this legend of what a boy thinks a carnival train is supposed to be like. And we're pairing that with the reality. And the reality itself starts to take on this sort of fantastic sort of this references to ghosts. The train comes alive, right? We can almost see this as, you think about The Hobbit and when Bilbo first sees the dragon, right? This mound of earth that comes to life, right? So we see these sorts of repetitions. I'd use more Greek mythology, but honestly, my Greek mythology is a little lacking, just so you know. So I have to sort of pull from slightly newer stuff. But this is sort of a ghost train, and it's the kind of thing that you can hear little kids telling each other about around the campfire, and then the train came, and you can almost imagine if you're 12 years old that's a scene you would retell to your friends the next day at school, right? And suddenly, again, the story lifts off the page and becomes mythical, right? Now, you add that to some of the other elements of the story. In that balloon, in that basket, there's an old crone. Right, she's called the Wax Witch. She's the fortune teller machine at the carnival, and she comes to the house in her balloon and tries to steal the little kids. Again, there's that evil witch, right? That's trying to capture children. And then, of course, you have Mr. Dark, who has this uncanny ability to offer people exactly what their hearts desire, and he does this so that he can lure them into a circus and enslave them and make them part of his own sideshow. And several people in town get captured this way. And one of the challenges for Will is to keep Jim from being one of them because he wants to be part of this world. So ultimately, the story starts to sort of reverberate in this sort of gigantic, elaborate Brothers Grimm sort of story that's been transplanted from the forests of Germany to the wheat fields of Illinois, right? So, you know, I could go on. I mean, I could probably find mythology in pretty much any of Bradbury's stories, and I could go on all day talking about it. And how he uses the structures and archetypes, and even the very language of myth. There's a lot of places where he references phoenixes, and there's all kinds of references to Greek gods and Shakespeare plays. Actually, in fact, Something Wicked This Way Come. Anybody recognize it? It's from Macbeth, right? So he's pulling from all these places. So I could do this all day long, but there's something else I wanted to point out, and that's one of the roles of myth and culture is to remind us of lessons of the past. So there has to be a certain amount of morality to some of these stories. So Bradbury isn't just, and the other thing that Bradbury is doing is he isn't just reminding us of these universal stories from our past. He's also creating new myths to sort of help us understand the things that are new to our own time. So if we look again at the Martian Chronicles, one of the things we see is, you know, on the surface, it's about the migration of man to Mars. But if we step back and we start to think about where that story might teach us about other things in our own world, what we start to see is actually the British occupation of India, right? We see the United States continental purge of Native Americans. The Martians are wiped out by chickenpox, right? So this story allows us to look at this idea of imperialism and colonialism in a way that divorces us from all the sort of things that we need to, that we come to stories with, all the political baggage, if you will. And that's, I think, why it's important to think about these stories in that way. And I think partly why Bradbury might have selected this style of writing, because he wanted to talk about these bigger ideas without getting bogged down in getting it right, right? Getting the history part of it right. So if we can suspend our disbelief and accept the fantastic, we're rewarded by being able to see things sometimes for the first time, right? So by setting the story on Mars, we can see the complexity of the forces at work on all sides because we're unfretted by national pride or the sort of the history that we're indoctrinated with from the very first day of school. This veneer of myth also gets at the core emotion of a situation without all the baggage that we bring to a story when we need that realism, right? Using the fantastic allows Bradbury to write about ideas without worrying about getting science, geography, or even facts right. And in this way, we get to the deeper truth, the capital T truth, right? He uses science and horror and magic not as things imbued with their own power, but rather as shortcuts to the emotional sort of truth of the lies of his characters. And I think one of the... So going back to that sort of example of the two guys on the rocket, right? Two guys are on a rocket, they're alone, they're going to Mars, and one guy turns to the other and says, fill in the blank, that, again, what's important in that story is what those guys are saying to each other, and not necessarily that they're on a rocket. And by putting it on a rocket, though, what he allows us to do is we're not going into that. Like, if those are two guys in an office, well, those of us that hate working in office are already going to have opinions about that. Those of us that love working in office are already going to have opinions about that. But how many of us have been on a rocket? Right? So we get to experience that emotional sort of moment between these two men purely as an emotional moment, on its own merits. And I think we can see this most clearly in one of the stories, and this is probably why it's taught in junior high so often in All Summer in a Day. And this is probably one of the first stories. I didn't really know it was a Bradbury story, but it's one of the first that I came across for sure. It's a classic bullying story, and I think it's the reason they teach it to junior high kids. It's about a young girl on Venus. Actually, how many of you, anybody familiar with this one? Okay, good. So I'll give you the whole summary then. It's about a young girl on Venus where it rains all the time, kind of like Oregon, right? Actually, worse than that, they haven't seen the sun in 7 years, right? And one of the problems with it, one of the problems in the story is basically there's this one little girl who was born on Earth, and her parents brought her to Venus when she was 4. So she remembers the sun. So 7 years out, the sun's about to come out for the first time, and the kids don't believe that she has seen the sun. They don't want to listen to her experience about the sun. And she writes this beautiful little poem about the sun and how it looks like a flower and all these things. And they get so mad at her for having this experience that they can't share that they lock her in a closet. And ultimately, it's the same day that the sun is coming out, right? So they lock her in the closet. Announcement, the sun is coming up, boys and girls, head outside, you've got 2 hours. They all run outside and leave her there. So the one person who needed to see the sun, the one person who wants to feel this light on her face again, is the one person who doesn't get to experience it because of the cruelty of these children. And they only realize it after the fact when they come in, and now they understand what it is that she missed, because now they're going to miss it too, right? So this is a story that they teach in junior high because it can get at the problem of bullying. It can get at the way a kid might feel when they're singled out for whatever reason. In a way that stories, real stories about kids getting bullied for their race or their intelligence or even their sexuality can't. Because depending on how those kids are brought up, they may come to those things with their own preconceived notions that they're already going to have feelings about race. They're already going to have feelings about the elitism of the intelligent, right? So depending on how they've been brought up, so they're not going to be able to see those stories and say, wow, that's horrible right away. That's something that's a certain amount of finesse that has to come later. So this is sort of a gateway for those kids to understand you got to be nice to each other, right? And ultimately, I think that that's sort of at the core of all good myth, that if you can teach a lesson about bullying and get kids to understand race and sexuality and poverty and intelligence and do it simply by depriving one little girl of the sun, that's incredibly powerful, right? And that's really what I'm talking about. So myth is something that has to parallel our own culture. And it has to parallel something in our own culture that we can't face head on. Death, the loss of innocence, loneliness, cultural alienation, whatever it is. By divorcing it from our common experience and all of our defenses and biases, we actually get to see it for the first time. And that's what all of Bradbury's work does. So in that sense, I think ultimately for me, sort of summing up here, it's this two-pronged attack of Bradbury and the retelling of the stories that we all know well. So it's like visiting old friends, right? And then adding to that this mythologization of the new experiences of our time. And I think maybe the reason he wrote Martian Chronicles is because we're obsessed with space now, right? That's a new experience for us. That's a myth about our new reality. If he can do that without calling attention to the moral, that's what gives Bradbury his staying power. And ultimately why the sci-fi label or the horror label is totally insufficient to define all of his work. I've started thinking about it, and I think maybe instead of calling him the greatest science fiction writer of all time, is that we can think of him as the greatest American mythologist, or the greatest American myth writer of all time. And that might be a better way to talk about the body of his work. And on that note, I just want to leave you with his sort of final thought on this. He says, if Martian Chronicles, and I'd add all of his work, but if Martian Chronicles had been technically efficient science fiction, it would have long since fallen to rust by the road. But since it is self-separating fable, even the most deeply rooted physicist at Caltech accepts breathing the fraudulent oxygen atmosphere I have loosed on Mars. Science and machines can kill each other off or be replaced, but myth, seen in mirrors, incapable of being touched, stays on. And if it isn't immortal, it certainly seems as such. And I'll sort of leave it there and sort of, I guess, open it up to questions. But that's sort of the end of my presentation. So. Deborah, do we want to use the microphone? Okay, I'll relay your question if people can hear it.
It's not a question. Do you want to know how we came up with the 451 Fahrenheit?
Oh, I can tell you. Supposedly he asked a science friend, and that was the number that they gave him for the temperature at which book paper starts
well,
to...
talk at Caltech.
Right.
Graduate student and...
Right. Well, what's ironic about that, that's actually one of the hard science fiction people.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that they get mad about, because apparently that's not true. That's not the temperature at which book paper spontaneously combusts. So that's where this sort of argument comes in. It's kind of interesting. But thank you. Other questions?
Yeah. I have two questions.
Okay.
One, I understand that Ray Bradbury was responsible for the concept of the butterfly effect.
Yes.
Chaos theory, in a sense.
Yes.
And you might want to comment on that. The other question I have is, as you've looked at all of the things, or as much as you've been able to look at, do you see any trends over time in his writing?
Interesting. All right, well, I'll answer the first question first. So the story, I believe it's actually called The Butterfly Effect is the name of the story. Actually, no, it's
Sound of Thunder.
Sound of Thunder, thank you.
Yeah.
So it's a short story that he wrote in which there's a time travel company. So there's one of those sort of science fiction moments that allows hunters to go back in time and kill dinosaurs. They can hunt dinosaurs, right? So the sound of thunder references the thunder lizards of dinosaurs, right? But the thing is that they go back and they have these hover pads that they keep sort of off the ground, because if you mess with anything, you're going to change the future. And they go back and they find the dinosaurs that are about to die of natural causes, and those are the only dinosaurs that you're allowed to kill, right? So they go back and they have these very specific things, and you're supposed to stay on the path, and there's all these rules, and one guy, of course, isn't really paying attention, and at one point, he steps off the path just with one foot, and he's like, uh-oh, and he sort of gets back up, and he goes back, and he does this thing, and then he goes back through the time machine, and he steps into the office. And I can't remember exactly what the detail is, but, like, the spelling of the company name is a little different, and it's, like, spelled phonetically, or, like, there's no O's in the English language anymore or something. And the owner of the company walks up to him, looks down, and he's got a butterfly crushed on his shoe. And that's basically where that concept comes from, that if you mess with anything in the past, it's going to have all these repercussions in the future. Which actually is a nice tie into sort of your second question, what are the sort of the trends? The only thing that I would say is I would say that Bradbury really moved away from science fiction later in his life, largely because I think he was so angry with the label. He speaks about it quite a bit in his memoirs. He saw the label of science fiction as being derogatory, and that once we slap that label on a book, it almost becomes irrelevant to culture in some way. But the weird thing, of course, is that science fiction and mystery and all these sort of genres are the most commonly read pieces. So that's what sort of the masses are reading, right? And that really angered him. And we see this again with Stephen King today. Stephen King has been dismissed as a literary sort of figure, but now he's editing, notable books of the year. He's writing all these reviews for the New York Times. I mean, he's become an institution in the literary community, even though his own work is sort of derided as being horror, right? So I think that would probably be, and I think it's a result of that. So in the 80s, he wrote almost exclusively on detective fiction. And in fact, some of the books you'll see upstairs, which are on the science fiction shelf, are actually books that they pulled from their general collection of fiction, because they're not science fiction. They are actually mystery. He wrote Private Eye stories. There's one, like I said, I don't know if I mentioned it, Death is a Lonely Business, is a great little hard-boiled detective fiction style book set in Venice, California, in the canals. And ultimately, the villain is a monster, like literally a monster. So we get that sort of fantastic myth. And it's a very specific monster from mythology that I won't tell you about, because you've got to read the book. It's great. I'd love to tell you about it, but it sort of ruins the story, so I won't go any further. Other questions? Roger? Who did he love to read? This again is, I think, adds to that idea of him being so fascinated by mythology, is most of the stuff that he talks about are sort of the French novelists of, like, the turn of the century, and he's reading all these classical pieces, Dante, there's all these references to Dante, he read a lot of Greek mythology, so he was really a classicist in that sense. But then he was also involved in a lot of science fiction communities and clubs. He was president of several. So he was also reading a lot of his contemporaries. But I think his work is drawing on... There's a long section, and I don't have it right here handy. There's a long section at the end of Fahrenheit, if you remember, where he's meeting all the people that have memorized books, and they're being introduced not as who they are, but as who they've memorized. And I think that that's a pretty telling list of the books that he's reading, and it's things like, Camus and Dante and, Kafka and all these sorts of people. So those are showing up as allusions in his work. So I think that would probably be the fairest thing to say. But others?
I spoke to him once, and he said that his favorite novel was, his own favorite novel, was Dandelion Wine.
Right.
My favorite.
Yeah. The Dandelion Wine, it's actually not one I'm too familiar with. It's one I really probably need to spend more time with. But it's also the one that's one of the ones that he gets sort of lambasted the most for, which is ironic. And I think he's often called naive and sort of overly nostalgic, and that's the book that people use in that criticism. But I think that nostalgia actually, and that sort of naivete, speaks more to his fascination with these sort of archetypal stories.
So, and I love that work. Some of my favorite stories by him are these very sort of warm, glowy sort of summer tale, Dandelion Wine. So, but yeah, it's an interesting sort of conundrum. But so he loved his own work too, Mendry. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Well, I wondered if Dimitri, which I've always thought was his most intentionally mythic book.
Okay. I have to admit, I've never read The Halloween Tree. It's one of the... I'm sorry. If I had known that would have been perfect. I would have started there. What I do know about The Halloween Tree is that that's actually... his TV adaptation of that is the adaptation that won him the Emmy. So it's a very well-received book in that format, but I really can't speak to it as a written work at this point. So, others? Anybody want to see the tattoo? I don't mind showing it. All right. So you'll probably recognize it. It's an adaptation of the original cover art for Fahrenheit 451. So to sort of piggyback, if anybody doesn't know, this is actually a Don Quixote figure made out of newspaper that's burning. So again, there's that sort of classical reference in his work. So, but yeah, so I'm a bit of a fan. That I feel bad about not being able to speak to the Halloween Tree now. So I've been outed. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
This is a perfect segue into Illustrated Man.
Oh, yeah. Illustrated Man, for those of you who don't know, is a collection of short stories where they're all linked, the sort of linked stories where there's a man that is the sideshow sort of freak with all the tattoos, but they move and each one tells its own story. And that's sort of how we get from one story to the next. So yeah, that's definitely, I've thought of that with the tattoos. Other things? Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.